Welcome to the award-winning Dare to Dream podcast with Debbie Dashinger, covering metaphysics, ETs, shamanism, and channeling. Here you will find spiritual inspiration from today's thought leaders, along with cutting-edge insights from our interstellar brothers and sisters and ancient shamanic wisdom. Now, here's a new episode of Dare to Dream with your host, Debbie Dashinger.
Welcome to Dare to Dream, where the extraordinary isn't fiction. It's the conversation. Dr. Diane Hennessy is here today. She's the renowned neuropsychiatrist, consciousness researcher, and the medical doctor and scientist you hear throughout the Telepathy Tapes podcast. And in the next few minutes, you're going to discover why her groundbreaking work with autistic savants, telepathy, and non-local consciousness is reshaping our understanding of the human mind. Stay with us during this entire show, because what Dr. Hennessy reveals will challenge neuroscience, expand your sense of reality, and offer a glimpse into the future of human evolution. If you would like to learn more about her, go to her website at drdianehennessy.com. That's HENNACY.com. And with that, I welcome Dr. Diane to the Dare to Dream show. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you, Debbie. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to start off by talking about the nature of autism and consciousness. I know, Dr. Diane, that you have called autistic children wired for the impossible. Mm-hmm. What are their brains accessing that neurotypical cognitive filters out? What do they access that we don't?
Well, one of the things to realize about them is that their filters are just, they're gone. I mean, they really are just wide open. So, for example, what I mean by that is that time is meaningless to them. They don't experience time as linear. So that the past and the present and the future are kind of all sort of simultaneously present for them. That can be really hard for us to wrap our heads around, but that is actually what Einstein said in his theory of relativity is the case, that our perspective on time is really an illusion. So that's one of the things they're showing us. Another thing that they're showing us is just other forms of non-locality. You know, so when we think of locality, we're thinking of, you know, here and now. And so besides being able to travel in time, what they are able to do is be somewhere else through, for example, clairvoyance or remote viewing, or whatever you want to call it. They're able to see things that are far away. And one of the things they describe is that they'll see things through someone else's eyes. I mean, particularly someone they're close with, like their mother's eyes. And another thing that they report is that they see entities. And the entities that they talk about the most are ones that they describe as angelic, angels, that and you know, or they're sometimes called teachers. But they say that they have these sort of guardians that are there, you know, helping them and teaching them, and that they're here to help evolve humanity.
They have angels and teachers helping them and guiding them, because it can't be easy coming into this world with what a lot of people look down on. I mean, you know, even imagine the stories of autistic people, children being institutionalized because nobody knew what to do with them. Nobody understood what was going on. And it's a very big mantle to take on in this life. And I feel in many ways that they are way showers. You talk about them being the next evolution. And I would agree with you, because we hear from so many factions that part of the next evolution of the new human is to be telepathic, much like the extraterrestrials from advanced civilizations. So How is it for them? It's very difficult, isn't it, for them in some senses for them to be them. I understand they have extraordinary relationships with each other, often with these beautiful parents who really get it, and these beautiful teachers and scientists such as yourself who understand how to access this brilliance in them. Talk a little bit about what it's like to be them.
Well, what you have to understand is that, first of all, the majority of the individuals who are part of the telepathy tapes were people who have what we call a regressive form of autism. And so that means that they were developing normally for the first year and a half or so of life, and then they regressed. And so they might have already been starting to speak, and then they lose the ability. They may have had certain skills like being toilet trained, and they may have lost that. I mean, that they lose sense of being in their body. They their proprioception, which is that ability of knowing where your body is in space, that gets disturbed. And so if you can imagine what that must be like for them when they're that young, to all of a sudden, when you're just starting to learn what you can do with your body, you're just starting to express yourself, and all of a sudden that's taken away from you. That's somewhat, traumatic. And at that stage in development, that's when I believe that we all come in a state of shared consciousness. And so it's during that first that during those years when you're between the ages of 1.5 and 3 that you're really developing a sense of self and separation from your parents, particularly your mother. And that's why you go through what people call it, like, the terrible twos or terrible threes, because they're just saying no to everything. It's because they're trying to assert that I can do things differently than what you want me to do. And so that gets disrupted. And so they stay in a state of shared consciousness with their parents. And they are able to know what their parents and others are thinking, but in how they're being treated for the first several years of their life is as though they're mentally retarded. Because there's so much emphasis put on, demonstrating that you're intelligent through your ability to speak and to write and to communicate. And so there's this prejudice that people have towards them. And yet what happens is that when you have these parents who are very, very dedicated, who just think, well, even though the professionals have told me that, there's no hope, my child's never going to be able to, amount to anything, I'm not going to give up on them. I'm not going to give up on my child. They love their child so much that they just, one of the parents will quit their job and just devote their time entirely to the child. I mean, I've seen that over and over again. And along the way, they discover this way of communication called spelling or rapid prompting method. There's different versions of it out there, but essentially what it is it's enabling them to communicate by having a large letter board, and you don't need as much fine motor coordination to be able to point to the letters on the letter board. So, and they're spelling out things. And what shocks the parents when they first see this is how much their child was picking up language, how much they were already understanding, and then they realize how brilliant their child is, and then they want to try to all the more so to get their child an education, and there have been individuals who've been able to go on to graduate from college. And so, but just put yourself in the shoes of someone like that, who for the first several years, people are talking in front of you as though you don't understand what's being said, and you're also picking up people's thoughts of you, and a lot of it is very negative. And what I see in these autistic individuals, one of the ways in which they are teaching us, is that they're not bitter. They're not resentful. They're very forgiving of all of that. And they just love, you know, they just love their parents so much. I mean, you know, it's just you just see such an incredible, beautiful relationship there. And so I think that one of the things they're teaching us, and this is one of the things that people talk about, is, you know, is the power of love, you know, and how important that is. But they're also teaching us that there are other ways in which we can access and process information, because they tell us that it's not just them who have these abilities, that it's as though, and maybe not just as though, if you go back to our ancestors, go back into antiquity, they knew a lot of things that we forgot, and we didn't just forget, but we were told were impossible. That we were told it's impossible to read somebody else's thoughts. Even though you have these indigenous cultures that they engage in that kind of communication all the time, we were told that it was impossible to access information outside of here and now, and yet, you know, they're demonstrating it. And so I think what they are here to do is to really kind of shake us out of our sense of limitation of what we can do as humans. And one of the things that I've seen is that a lot of what limits us is our own belief system. You know, if we think something's impossible, then it's not going to happen. And when they'd see demonstrations, like you saw when you saw Lidu, and her mother Dahlia, at Contact in the Desert, when you see things like that, if you have never seen it before and you thought it was impossible before, after you see it, you go, wow, it really is possible. And then it makes it actually more possible for you to actually learn those abilities yourself.
Absolutely. Just for reference to folks who are watching, listening, what Dr. Diana is talking about is I heard her speak in May at an event, which was wonderful. And then subsequently, she was on a panel, and part of the panel involved an autistic, I think she looked like she was young, young teenage gal. Nonverbal, who did use this spelling apparatus being described, and the mother, and they're deeply connected. And so they were giving us an experience of her telepathic skills. And it was everything from things that the MC came up with, people in the audience. It was very random and spontaneous. This autistic gal, perfect, everything that was being thrown at her, she knew. And she was so beautiful too towards the end. This part actually moved me a lot. I feel like she felt us as an audience appreciating her, supporting her. And I don't know if you remember, Dr. Diane, she started singing Happy Birthday to us. And there was something, I don't know, it was very precious for me because I could feel her joy in singing to us like that.
And it turned out it was the birthday of somebody in the audience, you know.
Was it really?
Yes.
And did she telepathically know this?
I believe so. And if you recall, just before she was going to do her demonstration, there was a fire alarm.
Yes.
And they were evacuating the room, you know, and they weren't evacuating all of the rooms in the hotel conference space. They were just evacuating our room. And Lidu, she looked over at me, and she was like saying, "This is a false alarm, you know," and was blasting loud, you know, wah, you know, really loud, you know, for everybody to get out. And I was so impressed with the fact that she didn't get rattled by it, because I mean, These autistic individuals are so sensitive. A lot of them are very, very introverted. They and this was her first time in front of a big audience. Okay, and literally right beforehand, that's when this thing went off. But then it did turn out to be a false alarm, and everybody came back in, and then she just went right to it, and was doing the telepathy with her mom. And yeah, she's, I mean, she's 100% accurate, and she's just a very, very sweet, sweet soul. She just turned 15 this past September. Yeah.
Very moving. And thank you for sharing that backstory. I did think about that. It was about as annoying an alarm as you can imagine. It was very strange. The timing I thought was fascinating. A lot of us sensitives probably picked up on that. And I love the fact that we were determined to do this and that we did what we needed to do rule-wise in the hotel, but we went right back in and carried on. And yeah, I give her so many props for being able to sustain throughout something so strange. Probably her knowingness of what was going on helped her so that she could come back. I'm really glad she did because even though I'm into this, I believe in this, still it is mind-blowing to see. And I'm very curious about DMT. So for folks, DMT is in a lot of things like ayahuasca or bufo. It's the chemical is it's quite a name. It's NN dimethyltryptamine, right? And it's a very powerful psychedelic, and it's usually found in plants and animal states, but is for autistics. Is there a neurological or a conscious-based overlap between autism and naturally elevated DMT levels?
I believe there is there. So what's interesting is if you look at the description of people who've taken ayahuasca, which is DMT combined with an MAO inhibitor that keeps you from breaking it down real rapidly. So it's the MAO inhibitor is basically interfering with the enzyme that would break it down so that it
Digest
wouldn't be
it.
active anymore. And people on that brew, they describe, out of body experiences. They also describe synesthesia, which is when you have your senses can blend together. So you might see colors associated with sounds, or you might see color, you might see auras, or colors around numbers, or but you can have a blending of any of the different senses. And people also describe telepathy. And they also describe getting downloads of information from, just from sort of this, like from entities, or from, from plants, or, but where they're just given this information that then gets verified as accurate afterwards. Okay, so that's the DMT experience. Okay, and then you compare that with these autistic individuals, and they have out-of-body experiences, they have synesthesia, they have the telepathy, and they get downloads of information from, from entities, that, as I said, the teachers. And so very, very, very similar. And I became aware of the fact that there was a study that was done in Italy where they looked at the urine of people with autism and people diagnosed with schizophrenia and people who are have none of those diagnoses, that have no psychiatric diagnosis. And what they found was a substantially higher amount of this compound in the urine of people with autism and schizophrenia that is not just related to DMT, it's actually more potent than DMT. And so you take that compound and you combine it with looking at the genetics of people who get diagnosed with autism. And what you see is that people who get diagnosed with autism, a lot of them, and I have no idea what percentage, but a lot of them have these genetic variants where it's like they're on an MAO inhibitor already. So it's that combination of their system is making more of this compound, and then they're also not breaking it down. And so it is really like they are on just a continuous sort of spirit journey. And they know how to navigate, live in two worlds at the same time, because that's how they describe it. It's like they're living in two worlds at the same time. They know how to navigate that because it's been so since they were so young that they don't really know much different.
Amazing. Somebody who's done ayahuasca, I know exactly everything you've described. I have experienced. I've done it 25 times, and I have had my life completely changed because a very benevolent, loving entity that I call the divine came and gave me very confusing at the time information, but it turned out to be so relevant, so poignant in who I am. And it was absolutely instructive and changed the course of what I do today. And that's what I was imagining as you were describing this ability to be here and yet navigating, because that's a pretty big, expansive place to be existing all the time, almost like a satellite dish. That's amazing and very skilled to be able to do that.
It really is. I mean, and then when you add on to that, then we're asking them to do the telepathy. Okay, so they're having to focus in just on the thoughts of the person they're asking them to be telepathic with when they're getting all of this information as well.
Yes.
Okay. And to then be, using this body that they have a more tenuous connection with to then spell what it is that they are picking up from the person they're telepathic with. I mean, we're asking a lot of them. And then, and then for Lidu to do that in front of a live audience, I'm just like, wow. I mean, it really, really is. It really is impressive. And one of the things I want to do, so that, that's the theoretical background on it. And so one of the things, so I've just co-founded a nonprofit institute to do research. And one of the research studies that I'm going to be doing with top scientists at UC Davis and Stanford and Louisiana State University, so top experts on DMT, we're going to be actually doing getting samples to test, the DMT, and similar compounds in these individuals to basically, to basically show that, yeah, that really, probably is what's going on, So I'm put two and two together, but nobody's put it all together where we're looking at, okay, this is what they're capable of doing, and then this is what their sort of biochemical profile looks like.
Amazing, because who knows from there and whatever your discovery is, what else is going on inside them with their wiring, with their genetics, with different markers that the rest of us don't have. I know one of the things that's talked about a lot is this idea of the hill. Why do you think that autistic individuals describe this hill? Doesn't matter their culture. Doesn't matter their age or their language, that there seems to be this place they all congregate that is not a physical location, but they all identify it the same and they gather all this incredible information. Talk about that.
Yeah, it was. I mean, when I discovered that that not just these autistic boys who knew each other already, who talked about going to the hill and being telepathic with one another, when I discovered that there were people that lived in other parts of the country that described going to the hill, I thought, wow, it really is, a thing. The more that I learned about it, the more I realized that it really is exactly what some of these ancient wisdom traditions like Hinduism and Tibetan Buddhism, what they describe advanced sort of mystics as being able to access. It's basically, they describe it as well as being, in similar terms, as being a very peaceful place, a sacred place, where you can download information that you that you're telepathic with other individuals there who are basically at the same level of consciousness. So one way to think of it is it's when you achieve a certain level of consciousness, that's where the space is. It's like think of it as like the top floor in the consciousness elevator.
You were talking also about history, and again, you brought up history, and it's very interesting. I'm reading a Dan Brown book right now called The Secret of Secrets, and it's actually predicated on a lot of the things you're saying, Diane. It is about non-locality. They do talk about remote viewing and consciousness, and of course, he develops a thriller, a story around it, but always like in Dan Brown novels, he's giving out a tremendous amount of information. And he talks about historically that even things like remote viewing, all the way back to Egypt, that these things have been around way before. So it's really interesting to hear you bringing them up again and this idea that they have this one sacred place where they can safely go and exchange information or be together. It sounds like from all the stories, they let each other know what's going on or somebody's passed away, what somebody might need. I mean, that's quite beautiful that they have the teachers, the guardians that are entities, but they also have each other in that level to depend on, to rely on. And I think that would be integral to their experience that they have each other's support and understanding.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it's been a huge relief to a lot of the parents of these individuals to find out that they do, they have friends. It's just that, they just get together with their friends in a slightly different way. It doesn't require mom to carpool. But because any mother wants their child to have friends and to have that experience and one of the things that's beautiful though is that a lot of them also form friendships here in the physical body. It's not just in the sort of spiritual and mental realm, and a lot of them have boyfriend and girlfriends, and it's just cute to kind of see the dynamic between them, that their personalities come out when they communicate, where there's this one gal and she's like, telling, her boyfriend Matthew, how hot he's looking today. He's like, "Oh, you're really hot today."
That's so sweet. Oh my. I love this. I love this for them, and I love everything they're teaching us. Do you think that autistic telepathy and extraterrestrial telepathy might arise from the same mechanism from non-local information access, that it could be somewhat of the same frequency?
Yeah, I think one of the ways to think about it is that, first of all, I mean, we live in a universe that has, I mean, how many zillions of, possible planets that are sustaining life, right? And then when you look at the way that it's all interconnected in this cosmic web, okay, so there's this huge interconnection, and there are these civilizations that are of different ages. Some of them are certainly more advanced than our own. And you look at how efficient telepathy is as a form of communication. The way that these autistic individuals demonstrate it and describe it's independent of language. So they can have somebody who doesn't even speak the same language as they do, and they can be telepathic with them.
Yeah, That's
which is
extraordinary.
yeah, but which really is extraordinary. Yeah, and so it's so what they're picking up on is something that is deeper than language itself, okay, and that gets then translated into the language.
Can you
And
talk about their teachers, their guardians, and the access they have way beyond the veil that we know? Have any of the autistic children or people ever reported experiences with extraterrestrial or extra-dimensional or extra-interdimensional beings? Are there any patterns there that you see?
well, they do describe interacting with beings from other star systems, you know, and in fact, you know, some of them will say that they're from, you know, like the Pleiades or, you know, or some other star system. And so, you know, being in contact with other you know, individuals from their star system is, you know, like, you know, that's just, you know, that makes total sense, right? You know, that they would be. They also describe, though, that we're in a spiritual war right now, that there is a spiritual battle, you know, that some of the entities that they see are angelic, and some of the entities that they see are kind of scary. And so they do things to try to scare off the demons, you know, so to speak. And you know, and the question is, you know, no matter what your thinking is, you know, how you think of angels and demons, you know, I think that, you know, I don't think we should get caught up in those kind of terminologies. You know, the way that I would see it is I'd see it as more that there's some energy that just feels really good, life-sustaining, attract very, you know, loving, attractive, you know, and then there's energy that's the opposite of that. And as we know, both energies exist.
100%. We're living in a planet of duality. And, that can be taken anywhere from the fact that there are people get very concerned about the extraterrestrial species, the multidimensional species that might not be so kind or loving toward humanity and Earth. But from what I understand, that's only 5% of what exists, and the other 95% is very benevolent. And so also in that realm, that makes sense that that could be some of the energy they pick up. And another realm, I mean, I think the energy we give off as a collective, because we're very much in a dualistic time on the planet of ascension. And what choices are we going to make? How are we going to treat the Earth as a resource and abuser? Are we going to uplift her and respect her and give back to all she gives to us? How are we going to treat each other? And we're at a very interesting crossroads in humanity. So on so many levels, they could be picking up what this energy is. And I have to give them a lot of credit for being so confident in this space that they go into that they could feel like they're scaring those negative, malevolent energies off and inviting in the benevolent energies even more so.
Yeah. Well, I think that, yeah, I think, you know, one of the ways to think about it is 'cause I'm also done work with people who are indigenous, and
Great.
so I incorporate my knowledge of, you know, what indigenous people say and ancient wisdom traditions with also what I know of, you know, cutting edge, you know, science and you know, and then what I learned from the autistic individuals, and I just see kind of a lot of this overlap. And one of the ways that this negative energy works is it's very insidious, because how it works is that it enters in as something that makes you start to feel bad, okay? And something that makes you feel fearful, something that makes you fear self-doubt, something that makes you, feel just these things that makes you then go down this sort of spiral of negativity. That's how it enters in. Because when you are in that state of, feeling depressed or anxious, fearful, contracted, when you're in that state, you're more easily manipulated and controlled, and so that's kind of how they that's how they work, is to orchestrate things to try to draw your attention to things. Like, look at all the stuff that's on the media these days. So much of it, what sells, is like fear, okay? And putting your attention into this thing that's making you go, you feel like hopeless and helpless about, the situation, whatever it is, because there's plenty of situations that we could feel that way about. And it's like, is that where you're going to put your attention? Or are you going to put your attention where you are, instead of being led, you're more a master of your own your own experience in life. Okay. What you're putting out there is this sort of confidence. And what I see is that when you're in that state, when you're in that state of feeling positive and loving and confident, things tend to go better. And that's not accidental. It's actually part and parcel of how the universe works.
Yeah, very well said. I love that. That's an important thing for everybody to hear right now, too, because any day people can go different ways. And I'm so happy to hear that you include the indigenous. I'm so involved with the shamanistic path. I really believe it has a lot of answers for us right now, and the ways they've chosen to live in reciprocity and right relationship. They're very important lessons, plus, obviously, nature and communing with nature. And, I'm with all this beauty that you're talking about, you have been so many things. You've been an architect. An artist, you still are an artist, you were in academia, and now here you are, this amazing path and all this incredible work and research. How has this changed your life? This information, this learning, all of what you're into and still becoming, how has it changed you?
Well, one of the things it's done is it's taken away any fear that I used to have. I have much more of a faith that things are how they're supposed to be. Okay, there've been so many things that have happened in a way that is so magical, kind of like the synchronicities and the ways in which it's like I've almost like I've been guided, okay, without me having some actual experience of a guide, okay, hearing in my ear or whatever, or seeing a guide. But somehow I've been guided. And I see that it all makes sense now. I've lived enough years that I see that it all makes sense. And so there's much more of a sense of peace, even though there's plenty of things I'd want to change about the world. But yeah, it's changed me in that way. It's also I've ever since I was a little kid, I've felt like I was on a mission, and it's sort of, it's now m made that make sense. Why I've made a lot of the choices that I've made, and so I'd say that has changed me in that way. It's also changed me in terms of just a level of gratitude. And a, de a real desire to, in a sense that, yeah, there is a way for humanity. I feel that we are, I don't just feel it, I know we're at a critical crossroads. And so I feel a tremendous responsibility to do what I'm doing, and that is, you know, getting the message out there that, you know, that the autistic individuals are here to provide and to really help humanity kind of get out of, you know, this funk that a lot of people are in, you know, and it's understandable because, I mean, people are caring. I'd say the majority of people really deeply care. But what happens is people have had to go, they're getting bombarded with so many things that you're like, it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that way. And oh no, that's so much pain and suffering and loss and this and that. And I've worked as a psychotherapist for, you know, 40 years, working with a lot of people who were severe trauma, you know, survivors. And so what's happened is that I really see how we can transform. Take you can't undo the hurt, but you can transform through it. And so I see that we're really at a place where we're going through all this chaos now and all of these mixed feelings, but I really am wanting to see if I can do my best to help the autistic individuals who are here to deliver a message so that people can kind of really, really move along in their transformational journey, because everything that we don't like, I think, is solvable if we really work on just what we can work on, and that is our own transformation of ourselves. So we're all here, you know, to do that.
Just beautiful. I really appreciate what you said. And I think that's so important to recognize. It is a responsibility. I really feel the same way with the work I do. It's my piece of the puzzle of heaven, right? As small, as grand, whatever it may be, but it is mine to do. And I feel also that magic of stepping onto a path and things blossoming before me, coming to me. I don't need to understand why, how, who, all of that, but I have been really aware of this precipice that I come up to, especially as it gets, you know, maybe a bigger stage, a bigger television, or something. And I always have that feeling of how could I say no? That would be the biggest regret for me to, you know, dim my light at this time instead of shining it brightly. So I love what you're doing, because this is such a unique, brilliant, and very future forward path you're on. And I want to take a quick pause, my friends. We are going to go a little deeper into this work. Before we do this, I've got something special for you, for folks who do want to find out about your galactic lineage, where in the stars and the cosmos you are from. Often it's many places. I've got a starseed report and a video to gift you with. If you spell my name correctly, you can get your gift. It's Debbie with an I and Dachinger with a C. So it's DebbieDachinger.com/starseed. Also, March 2026, Adventure of a Lifetime, 10 days out on the Celebrity Cruise Line for a mystery school at sea. I am speaking with some of the most magnificent presenters. I'm very honored. And where are we going? Greece and Turkey. We're going to all the ancient sites. We're going to have a mystery school experience. The presentations are included. The meals are included. Your cabin is included. People are signing up. So definitely get your cabin before it sells out, because it did on the last cruise that I spoke on. And that's Mystery School at Sea, SEA, mysteryschoolatsea.com. Click on my name under referral, Debbie Dachinger. Tonight is the last shamanic galactic healing I'm doing of the year. It is December 10th, 4 p.m. Pacific. Join us, debbiedashinger.com/healing. And I'm going to be doing an activation around ending suffering so you can start to put your light out into the world way more brighter. And very exciting, starting January 6th, I am opening up for the first time Shamanism Level 1. For those of you who have felt the call, want to become a healer, want more in your life, even just for yourself, your friends, your family, you don't have to have a career around this. Believe me, it'll change your life. We are beginning the practices, the tools, and there's only 14 seats left at this time. If you want to join, go to debbiedashinger.com/L1. So it's L and the number one for level one. Dr. Diane Hennessy and I are both speaking at the LA Conscious Life Expo, February 20th to the 23rd, 2026. I have been there every year, not for their 24 years, but for at least a decade. It's the greatest event. If you want to see her speak live, I'm pretty sure she's also on a panel. Definitely get your tickets. This is the event of the year, and what a way to start the new year. debbiedashinger.com/CLE. I want you to know for Conscious Life Expo CLE, I want you to know that all the links, all the URLs in order to connect further deeper are in the show notes, in the description, including two links I'm going to provide, because if you would like to help Dr. Diane with the funding for some of the extraordinary projects she's got going on, I'm going to offer you a PayPal link for her, also a Venmo link. So for all this brilliant research she's doing right now and getting into, you can get involved too. They're on her website too, but I'm going to give you those links. And finally, if this conversation, if all the conversations on the many 18 years I've been doing this show mean something to you, hype the video. It helps. Your support by subscribing, by liking, by leaving a comment actually helps us to reach more parents, people connected to autistics, starseeds, light workers all around the globe. We actually need your help to support us. You are our community. So go ahead. Once I publish a video or you're listening to us through audio, just go ahead and like this, comment, subscribe. It means a lot. Please do it. Okay, I want to talk, bringing back Dr. Diane, I want to talk to you about animals. And in this case, I'll bring up dogs. And they often respond telepathically to autistic children. I want to ask, what does this mean? What does this reveal about the animal consciousness and connection?
Oh, well, I think animals are, I think that many of them, if not all of them, have their own sort of telepathic abilities. And what I mean by that is that, and it may not be, I mean, it's not going to be like what you see with this autistic child where they can give you a, you know, random six-digit number, you know, I mean, not that kind of thing, but they pick up so much. So for example, I had a dog named Nikki, and I didn't realize that she had gone deaf because of she had acquired surfer's ear from swimming in the Pacific. I used to live in San Diego, and she was deaf, but I didn't know it because she would always, you know, come when I called her name. But I noticed that there were times when she didn't react to a sound. And so one day I thought, well, I'm just going to just think, Nikki, come, you know, and start playing with, you know, not speaking it out loud. And sure enough, she'd come. And I was like, okay, she's picking up on this. I'm familiar with Rupert Sheldrake's work that you know, there's that book of his, Dogs Who Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home, and you know, where he documents, you know, not just with dogs, but cats and parrots and, you know, other animals that, you know, that they're tuned in to, you know, whoever it is that they're bonded with. And so I really think that this interconnection, this web of life, you know, is not just between people, You know, that there's this interconnection that really includes other species as well, and that we're really all meant to be living in a harmony, and that's really actually more of our natural state.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And what an amazing story about Nikki. That's very interesting that Nikki would still come, although deaf. And my animals are so loud to me in my head, and I'm sometimes shocked that nobody else hears them. Like, don't you understand they want water? Or don't you understand? I could tell you some interesting ones. My dog was asking to be put in the bathtub, and the bathtub, there's no water in it. Sometimes she'll lay in it, sometimes she wants to drink from that particular spout. I don't know why, but I hear these things from her and I respond to them. And I'm sure that's what cemented it over the many years for us, that I respond to her so quickly. And I was thinking earlier when you were talking about these spelling machines that the nonverbal autistics can get. One of the gifts that I've gotten, someone in my family and someone in this house, is the same, but for dogs, right?
I
So you
got my
can.
daughter one of those.
You did.
With the buttons that they can hit to communicate.
Exactly. I am so excited to see what that creates. And I want to put some interesting words in there. So these are for animals, for anyone who doesn't know, and they're different colors, and you can record your voice, or they can come pre-recorded. And then the dog, cat, whatever the animal is, horse, can learn that when they press this, the response is they get what they asked for. And I think, like, much like what you were saying earlier, how fascinating the parents must feel, I know I'll feel, to start to understand the massive intelligence that they're constantly living in. The only thing is, I don't want my dog to constantly press the food button.
That's the thing. That's the danger there, you know. But yeah, I mean, my dog Mickey understood so many words, and I'll never forget this one. She used to sit up on the sofa next to my patients as my co-therapist, and she'd sit up. She'd sit almost like a person, okay? And I remember this patient once said, that he was struggling, and he said, "I really need somebody to, hold my hand, And he had his hand out like this, and Nikki took her paw and put it right in his
Wow.
We both burst into laughter, yeah. And she would also, she would get jealous when somebody could show me a picture, somebody could show me a picture of their child, okay, and she'd be fine with it, and be, "Oh, what a cute baby," whatever. But if they showed me a picture of their puppy dog, she would get so jealous.
Amazing.
Isn't that funny?
So she could even perceive there was a dog in the photo and you were responding positively to the
That's right.
dog. But wait, I'm your dog. I'm the one.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. She would, so, if somebody handed me a photograph, or handed me their phone with a picture on it or something, she, if it was another dog, she would jump off the sofa and start, nudging at me. But if it wasn't a dog, if it was like, somebody showing me their baby or, their new boyfriend or whatever, she didn't care. And so I just thought that that was very, very interesting.
Yeah, not there if it's a baby or a boyfriend, but another dog. Wow. So these children, these spiritual savants, and I'll just say for folks, savants meaning genius level abilities in a limited area. So such as math, such as music, which I love that they can do music, memory. What are their gifts uniquely attuned to?
When you say what are they attuned to, what I'd say is one of the ways to think about them is that A lot of their gifts are what we think of as more like right hemisphere versus left hemisphere. And this is a little bit oversimplistic about the brain, but but purposes here, this is really accurate enough. And so if you think of the left hemisphere, that's language based. And a lot of people, the majority of people are verbal thinkers. And so when they're thinking something through, what do they experience? They experience a voice in their head that is kind of going through, the sort of linear logic, rational, thinking about whatever, right? But there are other forms of thinking that are right hemisphere based. Intuition's one of them, where you just know something. And it's not that you know it because you were that you had a thought that led you there. It's like you just know it. Or if you look at things like music or mathematics, which are savant skills, this ability to sit down and play music that you just heard once, okay, and you just sit down and play it. And you may not have even had much in the way of music lessons at all. That is a profound example of pattern recognition. Mathematics is also about pattern recognition. So for that kind of cognitive style, it's not about this linear, A plus B equals C, da 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 da. It's more you're recognizing it like almost like a picture. You're recognizing like all of this information all at once. You're recognizing and how things relate to one another. And so it's an extremely efficient processing style, but it's also one in which it's just like it's like a download of the whole thing, as opposed to, it's like the download of the whole symphony rather than a note by note learning of it.
It's very interesting to me. So, as opposed to parroting something back, it's when you call it a download, it's like of the holistic whatever just happened, whether it's a mathematical or an orchestral or a vocal piece that they have the ability to note for note, number for number, whatever it is, replicate and repeat perfectly. And they can do this across the board. Whatever is in that realm, they're able to ingest it and replicate it.
Well, they tend to have their specialties, just like like anybody else, and so even though the mathematics skill is really that, and the musical skill really are both using pattern recognition, to an extraordinary degree. That you generally you don't see, the savants that are, both mathematicians and musicians. So there's no reason why they couldn't be. It's just that they tend to specialize. They tend to get really focused on one particular thing, and so, and some of them just gravitate more towards music, and some of them gravitate towards mathematics, and some of them gravitate towards art. I mean, so it's whatever they really feel called to do. But a lot of them are really, really interested in the sciences and math, and they really want to be in a position where they can be advancing, science and technology, so that they can really make the world a better place.
Interesting, advancing, because one of the autistic individuals described himself as a future human being. How do you think the autistic traits foreshadow humanity's next cognitive evolution?
Well, I think that so what we're seeing here now is that, first of all, let me just say, evolution is it's this natural sort of force, okay, where we're sort of designed as living beings to evolve to meet the new environment that we're in. Okay, so that you have environmental pressures that are leading the evolution. Okay. And so when you see the quickening of information now, just think about how much information we're exposed to now compared to how much information we were exposed to 20 years ago. I mean, it's really exponential. And so then how do you process all of that information? You need to have a more efficient processor. And so what's happening is that we're shifting away from the more language-based, linear, slow processing to processing that is more efficient in gestalt. And it's kind of like what we're seeing, like with, like computers, when they first started off, computers were extremely slow and they were binary based. It's all of this really, it took a lot of code just to get it to do something very, very simple. Well, now we all, most people own a computer, and look at what it's able to do. Okay. Well, so similarly, it's because we're interacting with computers and all of that information so much of the time, it's forcing us to evolve as well. And that's a good thing because in order to solve the kind of problems that we have, we need a different kind of approach to them. There's this saying, it's a famous saying that you can't solve the problems by the same way of thinking that created the problems. And so what we're seeing is this evolution towards cognitive styles that are that are more advanced. And so that's one thing. And I think that what we need to do is we need to really rethink our educational system. We need to really rethink what kind of jobs people are going to have, because as we're seeing a lot of jobs getting replaced by, whether it's AI or robots or, these automated systems, there's still something that we as human beings have to offer that can't be replaced. And so that's the sector that needs to grow.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that moved me so deeply with learning all this information and following all the work you've been doing is that the autistic children will often say that they feel unseen and unheard. And they relate to that wound. That is a core childhood wound with me that still rarely, but occasionally can get triggered for me, when I'm in a situation where that there's a pattern of that. And so, it felt kind of emotional for me, very empathically for me to hear them talk about that because I know what that feels like. And what is the deeper emotional or spiritual root of that disconnect? And how can we truly meet them?
Well, I think that it is like you were saying, it is something that a lot of us we have an echo of. We have a way in which we can sort of imagine what it must be like for them because we've experienced some of that ourselves. And I think particularly when you're doing things that are on the cutting edge, that are more, like what I do, what you do. I mean, when you're doing those sorts of things, you can have a lot of people don't understand you. That you're going to just get misunderstood left and right. And when you get misunderstood, that's a form of being unseen, okay? Because they're not really truly seeing you. They're seeing their own projection onto you as to who you are. Similarly, these autistic individuals have people projecting onto them that they're mentally retarded when they're not. And so that's where, or that people don't take the time to sit with them to give them the opportunity to express themselves. But, it's sort of like, oh, well, it's like, oh, well, this communication, if a person has that kind of attitude of, oh, this takes forever, I'll talk to the kid who can communicate quicker. That's another form of not being seen. And so what they're inviting us to do is to realize that actually they have a way of communicating that's even faster. They're getting judged as being too slow in their form of communication, but they're saying, well, the only problem here is that you're not telepathic. You need to learn how to be telepathic with me so that you can then have an even speedier conversation with me than what you could have with someone else. And so that's really the crux of the situation, because their minds are very, very fast. I mean, it's like they're processing it at incredible speeds, and the spelling is incredibly slow for them too. And they get frustrated sometimes because it's like they just know so much. And I think about how, for me, because I'm a pattern thinker myself, and that's one of the reasons why, and it runs in my family. I have a lot of mathematicians and musicians in my family, and I had to learn how to communicate my thoughts in words because my thoughts were not linear. I didn't, and to me, like having to write was like having to breathe through a straw. It just felt like it was like coming out so slow compared to the information that I had. Or another thing is just like, in writing this book that Wired for the Impossible, it's like, boy, I could think of how it was like, where do I even start? Because it's really all of these pieces fit together beautifully into the puzzle, and I understand that they're all part of it, but when you're reading this part, you're not going to know about the other parts that don't come until later. And so trying to think about
Interesting.
how do I, lay that out for people? Because, in logic, or mathematical proofs, you usually do that in a linear way. It's like, okay, this, then that, then this, and there's a progression that you lead people through. But if the true understanding comes from seeing all of those things at once and how they all feed one another, then it's harder to put it into that progressive language. And so that was one of the challenges in writing the book. But I really think that that's the this being misunderstood and having people just project their own thing onto you, it is so wounding. And so then we have to ourselves look within and say, okay, am I going to allow myself to be wounded by that? What part of me is abandoning me to allow myself to be wounded by that?
I've learned so much from you today. I really have. And this last piece, yet again, something I never considered. I'm so grateful you went to all the places and spaces you did. I am also a pattern recognition singer. And there's so much I've been singing since I'm little. And my grandfather, he was magnificent. He was very big in the music world, and he helped me so much because I couldn't do what everyone in my family did. I couldn't do music theory, and I went twice. It was an overwhelming, almost dyslexic jumble of information. So all the things that other people could see in sheet music, I could not. However, I have been singing since I'm little, and I have perfect pitch, and this pattern recognition, I never had a name. I've always just called myself a jukebox because I hear things and they get siphoned right out of me. Perfect. Just like what I heard, or I can do a counterpart. Sometimes it depends what gets activated when I hear it. I can do a counterpart to that musically, which is it's just thrilling and fun. And I also have the ability to see music with synesthesia, with the colors, and like it's a matrix. Like I can travel through music. I don't know how to explain it, but sometimes I even know what's coming before musically, something I've never heard before. I know it's going to happen, and I'm already singing it with it when it arrives. So it's sort of thrilling for me to hear you say this. And even this thing about the book, when I'm working with clients or groups, I receive these massive downloads of information. And I have to tell people because it looks like I'm going really quiet, but I have to tell them I'm actually still with you. You'll have to forgive me, but there's a lot happening. And then I feel like I have to compartmentalize it so that I can start to disseminate to the person the most important things I just heard for them, right? It's like this massive zip file. And I sometimes call it that there's a group of beings sitting around a round table, and they all started talking at once and giving me information, and I can digest it. I understand. But then I have to, in order to do something out here with a group or with people, I really have to take a pause with all of it and sort of put it someplace so that almost like bubbles, I don't know how else to say it. I can talk about this, I can talk about that. Some of them, I know that's not so important. It's very interesting, all of this. And it even makes me wonder how much some of us have these overlaps with some of these qualities that you're talking about.
Well, that's the thing is that a lot of people, when they hear me talk, they start to or like read some of my writing. They start to go, "Wow, that I never thought about it, but that's actually an experience I have." And so I really think that that this evolution's been going on for a while. So you were part of that wave. Perfect pitch is something that's common in these autistic individuals. And so what that suggests is that you have a higher resolution. Think of it in terms of that we live in a sea of information that's encoded in waves, okay, and sound waves, and then light waves, and a lot of them are not within our audible or visible range, but the information's still encoded in all of these waves. And what we do is our brains and our sensory organs are frequency detectors. And our brains as pattern decoders. Okay, so it's like we're taking the we're tuning into different frequencies, and our brains are actually analyzing the patterns within that. That's just me speaking and you being able to understand what I'm saying. That's what my voice is. I'm emitting sound waves, and there's a pattern to those. Within those sound waves that you're recognizing as meaningful. And that's what the brain does all the time, and we take it for granted because we do it all the time. Well, just imagine having just some of those skills that just get applied to something else that or for example, just facial recognition. We have the ability to recognize somebody even if we hadn't seen them for 10 years, and they may have changed, and yet we recognize them, even though there's so many people. You'll be walking down, a busy, busy street, in a town that was not where you knew them, and you're like, oh my gosh, Mary, I hadn't seen you for 10 years. How do you re That's a very sophisticated algorithm that your brain is able to do with the pattern recognition. Well, imagine having those same kind of algorithms applied to other things. And it so much of it is, what are you applying it to? What is it that's important to you? And so for most of us, because we're social beings, people's faces and recognize, people's faces are important to us. People's voices are important to us because it's all about identifying who this person is, because relationships are important to us. But the brain can be using those same algorithms to do other things.
That's so true. I mean, you can even go to a high school reunion. You haven't seen people in 20, 30, I guess they go on forever, these reunions, 40, 50 years. And somehow, even though these people have aged, gotten bald, gotten fat, gotten this, people at some point you click in and there's a remembrance of like, oh yeah, you are, and you see that face, that recognition. You're talking about that is very interesting. I want to also offer to you or through you, I understand that the autistic individuals enjoy sound baths, and my partner and I do them. And so we wouldn't know who to reach out to, but we would absolutely avail ourselves. It would be our honor, joy, and pleasure to do one, to do many for any autistic individuals who would like to come. So if you want to hook me up afterwards, when we're out of this, I just wanted to make that offer official.
Oh yeah, well thank you. You're talking about there in LA then?
Yeah, I think that would be the easiest, instead of flying places, but we are in Los Angeles. So if there's places anywhere in LA County, in the valley, anywhere that we can drive to, easily, we would be happy to.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. And so you've mentioned a book. I know you've got research, but I want people to know really what's going on for you right now. How can people find you? What are you doing? How can we get involved and follow you?
Okay. Well, you can find me at Dr. Diane Hennessy, HENNACY.com. And I have a lot of speaking engagements this coming year. I'd have even more if I if it wasn't for the fact that some of them overlap in time, and so I can't be two places at once. So you can find, some of the events that I'm going to be speaking at. You mentioned one of them earlier, the Conscious Life Expo. I'll be at Contact in the Desert again this year. And then I recently founded this nonprofit research institute. So if people want to donate, it's tax deductible. And what I'm excited about is the Hennessy Institute is really for, it's not just for these non-speaking autistic individuals. It's really for all of neurodivergence. So, you would fall in that category, for example. Because what I want to do is, I really want to understand, map out, all of these different abilities that people have, and then see what is it that we can do to maximize people's ability to be fully who they are. What is it that is really going to be the most helpful? I'm interested in things like sound therapy and light therapy, and I'm also interested in retreats in which people go into nature. And I live in the beautiful state of Oregon, where there's just so much just amazing nature here. We've got the redwoods and oceans and rivers and mountains. It's just fantastic. And helping people to really learn about themselves, because that's one of the things, like, just in talking with you today, I brought up some things, and I think you learn a few things, that it was like you already knew things about yourself, but it's more that now you have kind of a framework to even think about them with.
Absolutely.
And so that's really, the plan is really that the research and also educational piece, some of the education is going to be to te be teaching people about neurodivergence, and, both for people that have family members that are neurodivergent, or professionals who are working with this population, but also to help to deliver the messages that these autistic individuals want to deliver, to help create the opportunities for them to be available for people who really find that they are transformed by having been in their presence. I've seen it over and over again, where I've had people that I've said, okay, you can come and meet some of the children I work with, and I see how people walk away, and they're transformed, and it's not just that they're mind blown by, what they actually see demonstrated for them, but it's also just the interaction, the kind of conversation that they have with them.
For folks who go to your PayPal or your Venmo to donate money, to offer funds, what are they paying for? What does that money go to?
Well, for right now, because I just started the institute, it's really what we need are some operating costs. I have everybody who is helping me out is totally volunteer. I don't have any paid staff, so I do a lot of it myself. And I can't clone me, and but if I can have some assistance, then I can do so much more. So we need operating funds. But then I also have some studies that I'm already I've got IRB approval, which is what you need in order to have a study that could be published. I have some studies that I've already started doing, mapping out some of the abilities of these autistic individuals. I mentioned earlier the DMT study. So it's really, helping with research that I hope to have published in scientific journals and peer reviewed.
I am definitely signing up on your website, drdianehennessy.com. I want to definitely stay abreast of what you're doing and what's possible and what's next. And Diane, this is Dare to Dream. What do you next dare to dream? What are your future dreams and goals?
Oh my. Well, I would say my dreams are really to really get this institute launched, and to really see where that goes, because I see so much potential. There's so much excitement about my work now, and there's so many people that want to be able to interact with me or interact with the autistic individuals. And so I'm really excited about creating that, and creating a better understanding of them so that their needs are met. I mean, we still don't have spelling accepted as a legitimate form of communication, and I want to see that change. And so one of the studies that I'm involved with is using eye tracking glasses so that we can track where their eyes are going, because they do look at the letter before they hit it. So it shows, that they're not just being it's not just that the person with the letter board is just engaging in wishful thinking, that the child's able to communicate using this device, that you can actually see, no, the child's actually looking at the what they're spelling beforehand, that they really are using it with intention.
Thank you so much for being on the show today. Thank you for the beautiful work that you do and for forging this very important path that I think is at a very important time on this planet.
Thank you.
I'm going to end today's show with a reminder of all the beauty that we talked about. When you learn to listen beyond the physical, we discover that nothing is ever lost. Everything is connected, and love is the only language the soul never stops speaking. Next week on the podcast, I am speaking with Pamela Downs, who shares live channeled messages that reveal the true, unfiltered experience of a modern channeler. Her live channelings are over 1 million on Instagram and so forth. And Pamela holds others steady in their light during times of collective upheaval by staying rooted in compassion and personal embodiment of higher consciousness. And of course, she'll be channeling on the show. This has been Dare to Dream for Curious Souls, connecting with extraterrestrial life, higher dimensions, and ancient shamanic wisdom. Be sure to subscribe right now. Hit that button to this number one transformation conversation and leave a comment. I'm very excited to hear what you got out of today's conversation.
Thanks for joining us this week on Dare to Dream. Make sure to visit our website, debbiedashinger.com. That's DEBBIDACHINGER. You can subscribe to the show on YouTube and all major podcast sites, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this program, we'd appreciate a like and comment, or tell a friend about the podcast. That will help us out as well. And if you like this conversation, you might want to check out Debbie's shamanic healing programs. And Debbie is available for coaching to write your book, and her company takes your finished book to guaranteed international bestseller. Be sure to subscribe for our next episode of Dare to Dream podcast with Debbie Dashinger, your number one transformation conversation.